marks. In the end, it went nowhere near Mount Mitchell, though it did take in Mount Washington, and then carried on another 350 miles to Mount Katahdin in Maine. Avery, who had grown up in Maine and done his formative hiking there, was most insistent on this. Essentially, it went where access could be gained, mostly high up on the hills, over lonely ridges and forgotten hollows that no one had ever used or coveted, or sometimes even named. It fell short of the actual southern end of the Appalachian Mountain chain by 150 miles, and of the northern end by nearer 700. The work camps and chalets, the schools and study centers, were never built. Still, quite a lot of the original impulse behind McKay's vision survives. All 2,100 miles of the trail, as well as side trails, footbridges, signs, blazes, and shelters, are maintained by volunteers. Indeed, the AT is said to be the largest volunteer-run undertaking on the planet. It remains gloriously free of commercialism. The Appalachian Trail Conference didn't hire its first paid employee until 1968, and it retains the air of a friendly, accessible, dedicated outfit. The AT is no longer the longest hiking trail. The Pacific Crest and Continental Divide trails, both out west, are slightly longer, but it will always be the first and greatest. It has a lot of friends. It deserves them. Almost from the day of its opening, the trail has had to be moved around. First, 118 miles in Virginia were rerouted to accommodate the construction of Skyline Drive through Shenandoah National Park. Then, in 1958, overdevelopment on and around Mount Oglethorpe in Georgia necessitated lopping 20 miles off the trail's southern end and moving the start to Springer Mountain, in the protected wilderness of the Chattahoochee National Forest. 10 years later, the Maine Appalachian Trail Club rerouted 263 miles of trail, half its total length across the state, removing the trail from logging roads and putting it back in the wilds. Even now, the trail is never quite the same from one year to the next. Perhaps the hardest part about hiking the Appalachian Trail is getting onto it, nowhere more than at its ends. Springer Mountain, the launching-off point in the south, is 7 miles from the nearest highway, at a place called Amicalola Falls State Park, which in turn is a good way from anywhere. From Atlanta, the nearest outlet to the wider world, you have a choice of one train or two buses a day to Gainesville, and then you're still 40 miles short of being 7 miles short of the start of the trail, as it were. To and from Katahdin in Maine is even more problematic. Fortunately, there are people who will pick you up in Atlanta and take you to Amicalola for a fee. Thus it was that Katz and I delivered ourselves into the hands of a large, friendly guy in a baseball cap named Wes Wisson, who had agreed to take us from the airport in Atlanta to Amicalola Falls Lodge, our setting-off point for Springer, for $60. Every year between early March and late April, about 2,000 hikers set off from Springer, most of them intending to go all the way to Katahdin. No more than 10% actually make it. Half don't make it past central Virginia. Less than a third of the way. A quarter get no farther than North Carolina, the next state. As many as 20% drop out the first week. Wisson has seen it all. "Last year, I dropped a guy off at the trailhead," he told us as we tooled north through darkening pine forests toward the rugged hills of North Georgia. 3 days later, he calls me from a payphone at Woody Gap. That's the first payphone you come to. Says he wants to go home, that the trail wasn't what he expected it to be. So I drive him back to the airport. 2 days after that, he's back in Atlanta. Says his wife made him come back because he'd spent all this money on equipment, and she wasn't going to let him quit so easy. So I drop him off at the trailhead. 3 days later, he phones from Woody Gap again. Wants to go to the airport. "What about your wife?" I says. And he says, "This time I'm not going home." "How far is it to Woody Gap?" I asked. 21 miles from Springer. Doesn't seem much, does it? I mean, he'd come all the way from Ohio. So why'd he quit so soon? He said it wasn't what he expected it to be. They all say that. Just last week I had three ladies from California, middle-aged gals, real nice, kind of giggly, but, you know, nice. I dropped them off, and they were in real high spirits. About 4 hours later, they called and said they wanted to go home. They'd come all the way from California, you understand? Spent God knows how much on airfares and equipment. I mean, they had the nicest stuff you ever saw, all brand new and top of the range. And they'd walked maybe a mile and a half before quitting. Said it wasn't what they'd expected.
What do they expect?
Who knows? Escalators, maybe. It's hills and rocks and woods and a trail. You don't got to do a whole lot of scientific research to work that out. But you'd be amazed how many people quit. Then again, I had a guy, about 6 weeks ago, who should have quit and didn't. He was coming off the trail. He'd walked from Maine on his own. It took him 8 months, longer than it takes most people, and I don't think he'd seen anybody for the last several weeks. And when he came off, he was just a trembling wreck. I had his wife with me. She'd come to meet him, and he just fell into her arms and started weeping. Couldn't talk at all. He was like that all the way to the airport. I've never seen anybody so relieved to have anything done with, and I kept thinking, well, you know, sir, hiking the Appalachian Trail is a voluntary endeavor. But, of course, I didn't say anything.
So can you tell when you drop people off whether they're going to make it?
Pretty generally.
And do you think we'll make it?
Said Katz.
He looked at us each in turn. Oh, you'll make it all right, he replied. But his expression said otherwise.
Amicalola Falls Lodge was an airy high on a mountainside, reached up a long, winding road through the woods. The man at the airport in Manchester had certainly seen the right weather forecast. It was piercingly, shockingly cold when we stepped from the car. A treacherous, icy wind seemed to dart around from every angle, and then zip up sleeves and pant legs.
"Jesus!"
Katz cried in astonishment, as if somebody had just thrown a bucket of ice water over him and scooted inside. I paid up and followed. The lodge was modern and very warm, with an open lobby dominated by a stone fireplace, and the sort of anonymously comfortable rooms you would find in a Holiday Inn. We parted for our rooms and agreed to rendezvous at 7. I got a Coke from a machine in the corridor, had a lavishly steamy shower involving many towels, inserted myself between crisp sheets. How long would it be till I enjoyed this kind of comfort again? Watched discouraging reports by happy, mindless people on the Weather Channel, and slept hardly at all. I was up before daybreak and sat by the window watching as a pale dawn grudgingly exposed the surrounding landscape, a stark and seemingly boundless expanse of thick, rolling hills covered in ranks of bare trees, and the meagerest dusting of snow. It didn't look terribly forbidding, these weren't the Himalayas, but it didn't look like anything you would particularly want to walk out into. On my way to breakfast, the sun popped out, filling the world with encouraging brightness, and I stepped outside to check out the air. The cold was startling, like a slap to the face, and the wind was still bitter. Dry little pellets of snow, like tiny spheres of polystyrene chased around in swirls. A big wall thermometer by the entrance read 11 degrees Fahrenheit.
"Coldest ever for this date in Georgia,"
a hotel employee said, with a big pleased smile, as she hurried in from the parking lot, then stopped and said,
"You hiking?"
"Yeah."
"Well, better you and me. Good luck to you. Brr!"
And she dodged inside. To my surprise, I felt a certain springy keenness. I was ready to hike. I waited months for this day, after all, even if it had been mostly with foreboding. I wanted to see what was out there. All over America today, people would be dragging themselves to work, stuck in traffic jams, wreathed in exhaust smoke. I was going for a walk in the woods. I was more than ready for this. I found Katz in the dining room, and he was looking laudably perky, too. This was because he had made a friend, a waitress named Rayette, who was attending to his dining requirements in a distinctly coquettish way. Rayette was 6 feet tall, and had a face that would frighten a baby, but she seemed good-natured and was diligent with the coffee. She could not have signaled her availability to Katz more clearly if she had thrown her skirt over her head and lain across his Hungry Man breakfast platter. Katz, in consequence, was pumping testosterone.
"Ooh, I like a man who appreciates pancakes," Rayette cooed.
"Well, honey, I sure appreciate these pancakes," Katz responded, face agleam with syrup and early morning happiness. It wasn't exactly Hepburn and Tracy, but it was strangely touching nonetheless.
She went off to deal with a distant customer, and Katz watched her go with something like paternal pride.
"She's pretty ugly, isn't she?"
he said with a big, incongruous beam. I sought for tact. "Well, only compared with other women." Katz nodded thoughtfully, then fixed me with a sudden fearful look.
"You know what I look for in a female these days? A heartbeat and a full set of limbs."
"I understand."
"And that's just my starting point, you realize. I'm prepared to compromise on the limbs. You think she's available?"
"I believe you might have to take a number."
He nodded soberly. "Probably be an idea if we ate up and got out of here."
I was very happy with that. I drained a cup of coffee and we went off to get our things. But when we met up outside 10 minutes later, togged up and ready to go, Katz was looking miserable.
"Let's stay here another night," he said.
"What? Are you kidding?" I was completely taken aback by this. "Why?"
"Because it's warm in there and it's cold out here. We've got to do it."
He looked to the woods.
"We'll freeze out there."
I looked to the woods, too.
"Yeah, probably.
We still got to do it." I hoisted my pack and took a backward swagger under the weight. It would be days before I could do this with anything approaching aplomb. Jerked tight the belt and trudged off. At the edge of the woods, I glanced back to make sure Katz was following. Ahead of me spread a vast, stark world of winter-dead trees. I stepped portentously onto the path, a fragment of the original Appalachian Trail from the days when it passed here en route from Mount Oglethorpe to Springer. The date was March 9th, 1996. We were on our way. The route led down into a wooded valley with a chuckling stream edged with brittle ice, which the path followed for perhaps half a mile before taking us steeply up into denser woods. This was, it quickly became evident, the base of the first big hill, Frosty Mountain, and it was immediately taxing. The sun was shining, and the sky was a hearty blue, but everything at ground level was brown. Brown trees, brown earth, frozen brown leaves, and the cold was unyielding. I trudged perhaps 100 feet up the hill, then stopped, bug-eyed, breathing hard, heart kabooming alarmingly. Katz was already falling behind and panting even harder. I pressed on. It was hell. First days on hiking trips always are. I was hopelessly out of shape, hopelessly. The pack weighed way too much, way too much. I had never encountered anything so hard, for which I was so ill-prepared. Every step was a struggle. The hardest part was coming to terms with the constant, dispiriting discovery that there is always more hill. The thing about being on a hill, as opposed to standing back from it, is that you can almost never see exactly what's to come. Between the curtain of trees at every side, the ever-receding contour of rising slope before you, and your own plodding weariness, you gradually lose track of how far you have come. Each time you haul yourself up to what you think must surely be the crest, you find that there is in fact more hill beyond, sloped at an angle that kept it from view before, and that beyond that slope there is another, and beyond that another, and another, and beyond each of those more still, until it seems impossible that any hill could run on this long. Eventually you reach a height where you can see the tops of the topmost trees, with nothing but clear sky beyond, and your faltering spirit stirs. Nearly there now, but this is a pitiless deception. The elusive summit continually retreats by whatever distance you press forward, so that each time the canopy parts enough to give you a view, you are dismayed to see that the topmost trees are as remote, as unattainable, as before. Still, you stagger on. What else can you do? When, after ages and ages, you finally reach the telltale world of truly high ground, where the chilled air smells of pine sap and the vegetation is gnarled and tough and wind-bent, and push through to the mountain's open pinnacle, you are, alas, past caring. You sprawl face down on a sloping pavement of gneiss, pressed to the rock by the weight of your pack, and lie there for some minutes, reflecting, in a distant out-of-body way, that you have never before looked this closely at lichen, not in fact looked this closely at anything in the natural world, since you were 4 years old and had your first magnifying glass. Finally, with a weary puff, you roll over, unhook yourself from your pack, struggle to your feet, and realize, again, in a remote, light-headed, curiously not there way, that the view is sensational, a boundless vista of wooded mountains, unmarked by human hand, marching off in every direction. This really could be heaven. It's splendid, no question, but the thought you cannot escape is that you have to walk this view, and this is the barest fraction of what you will traverse before you've finished. You compare your map with the immediate landscape and note that the path ahead descends into a steep valley, a gorge, really, not unlike the gorges the coyote is forever plunging into in Roadrunner cartoons, gorges that have actual vanishing points, which will deliver you to the base of a hill even more steep and formidable than this, and that when you scale that preposterously taxing peak, you will have done 1.7 miles since breakfast, while your schedule, blithely drawn up at a kitchen table and jotted down after perhaps 3 seconds' consideration, calls for 8.9 miles by lunch, 16.8 by supper, and even greater distances tomorrow. But perhaps it is also raining, a cold, slanting, merciless rain, with thunder and lightning playing on the neighboring hills. Perhaps a troop of Eagle Scouts comes by at a depressing trot. Perhaps you are cold and hungry and smell so bad that you can no longer smell yourself. Perhaps you want to lie down and be as the lichen, not dead exactly, but just very still for a long, long time. But of course I had all of that ahead of me. Today I had nothing to do but traverse 4 middling mountains over 7 miles of well-marked trail in clear, dry weather. It didn't seem too much to ask. It was hell. I don't know exactly when I lost track of Katz, but it was in the first couple of hours. At first I would wait for him to catch up, bitching every step of the way, and pausing after each 3 or 4 shuffling paces to wipe his brow and look sourly at his immediate future. It was painful to behold in every way. Eventually I waited to see him pull into view, just to confirm that he was still coming, that he wasn't lying on the path palpitating, or hadn't thrown down his pack in disgust and gone looking for Wes Wisson. I would wait and wait, and eventually his shape would appear among the trees, breathing heavily, moving with incredible slowness, and talking in a loud, bitter voice to himself. Halfway up the third big hill, the 3,400-foot-high Black Mountain, I stood and waited a long while, and thought about going back, but eventually turned and struggled on. I had enough small agonies of my own. 7 miles seems so little, but it's not, believe me. With a pack, even for fit people, it is not easy. You know what it's like when you're at a zoo or an amusement park with a small child who won't walk another step? You hoist him lightly onto your shoulders, and for a while, for a couple of minutes, it's actually kind of fun to have him up there, pretending like you're going to tip him off or cruising his head towards some low projection before veering off, all being well, at the last instant. But then it starts to get uncomfortable. You feel a twinge in your neck, a tightening between your shoulder blades, and the sensation seeps and spreads until it is decidedly uncomfortable, and you announce to little Jimmy that you're going to have to put him down for a while. Of course, Jimmy bawls and won't go another step, and your partner gives you that disdainful, "I should have married the quarterback" look, because you haven't gone 400 yards. But hey, it hurts. Hurts a lot. Believe me, I understand. Okay. Now imagine 2 little Jimmys in a pack, on your pack, Or, better still, something inert but weighty, something that doesn't want to be lifted, that makes it abundantly clear to you as soon as you pick it up that what it wants is to sit heavily on the ground. Say a bag of cement or a box of medical textbooks. In any case, 40 pounds of profound heaviness. Imagine the jerk of the pack going on like the pull of a down elevator. Imagine walking with that weight for hours, for days, and not along level asphalt paths with benches and refreshment booths at thoughtful intervals, but over a rough trail full of sharp rocks and unyielding roots and staggering ascents that transfer enormous amounts of strain to your pale, shaking thighs. Now tilt your head back until your neck is taut, and fix your gaze on a point 2 miles away. That's your first climb. It's 4,682 steep feet to the top, and there are lots more like it. Don't tell me that 7 miles is not far. Oh, and here's the other thing. You don't have to do this. You're not in the army. You can quit right now. Go home, see your family, sleep in a bed. Or, alternatively, you poor, sad schmuck, you can walk 2,169 miles through mountains and wilderness to Maine. And so I trudged along for hours, in a private little world of weariness and woe, up and over imposing hills, through an endless cocktail party of trees, all the time thinking, I must have done 7 miles by now, surely. But always the wandering trail ran on. At 3:30, I climbed some steps carved into granite and found myself on a spacious rock overlook, the summit of Springer Mountain. I shed my pack and slumped heavily against a tree, astounded by the scale of my tiredness. The view was lovely. The rolling swell of the Cohutta Mountains, brushed with a bluish haze the color of cigarette smoke, running away to a far-off horizon. The sun was already low in the sky. I rested for perhaps 10 minutes, then got up and had a look around. There was a bronze plaque screwed into a boulder announcing the start of the Appalachian Trail, and nearby on a post was a wooden box containing a Bic pen on a length of string and a standard spiral notebook, its pages curled from the damp air. The notebook was the trail register. I had somehow expected it to be leather-bound and funereal, and it was filled with eager entries, nearly all written in a youthful hand. There were perhaps 25 pages of entries since the 1st of January, 8 entries on this day alone. Most were hurried and cheery. March 2nd. Well, here we are, and man, it's cold. See y'all at Katahdin, Jamie and Spud. But about a third were longer and more carefully reflective, with messages along the lines of, So here I am at Springer at last. I don't know what the coming weeks hold for me, but my faith in the Lord is strong, and I know I have the love and support of my family. Mom and Pookie, this trip is for you. And so on. I waited for Katz for 3/4 of an hour, then went looking for him. The light was fading, and the air was taking on an evening chill. I walked and walked, down the hill and through the endless groves of trees, back over ground that I had gratefully put behind me forever, or so I had thought. Several times I called his name and listened, but there was nothing. I walked on and on, over fallen trees I had struggled over hours before, down slopes I could now only dimly recall. My grandmother could have got this far, I kept thinking. Finally, I rounded a bend, and there he was, stumbling towards me, wild-haired and one-gloved, and nearer hysteria than I have ever seen a grown person. It was hard to get the full story out of him in a coherent flow because he was so furious, but I gathered he had thrown many items from his pack over a cliff in a temper. None of the things that had been dangling from the outside were there any longer. "What did you get rid of?" I asked, trying not to betray too much alarm. "Heavy fucking shit, that's what. The pepperoni, the rice, the brown sugar, the spam, I don't know what all. Lots. Fuck." Katz was almost cataleptic with displeasure. He acted as if he had been deeply betrayed by the trail. It wasn't, I guess, what he had expected. I saw his glove lying in the path 30 yards back and went to retrieve it. Okay, I said when I returned. You haven't got too far to go. How far? Maybe a mile. Shit, he said bitterly. I'll take your pack. I lifted it onto my back. It wasn't exactly empty now, but it was decidedly moderate in weight. God knows what he had thrown out. We trudged up the hill to the summit in the enveloping dusk. A few hundred yards beyond the summit was a campsite with a wooden shelter in a big grassy clearing against a backdrop of dark trees. There were a lot of people there, far more than I'd expected this early in the season. The shelter, a basic three-sided affair with a sloping roof, looked crowded, and a dozen or so tents were scattered around the open ground. Nearly everywhere there was the hiss of little camp stoves, threads of rising food smoke, and the movements of lanky young people. I found us a site on the edge of the clearing, almost in the woods, off by ourselves.
"I don't know how to put up my tent,"
Cat said in a petulant tone.
"Well, I'll put it up for you then."
"You big, soft, flabby baby." Suddenly, I was very tired. He sat on a log and watched me put up his tent. When I finished, he pushed in his pad and sleeping bag and crawled in after. I busied myself with my tent, fussily made it into a little home. When I completed my work and straightened up, I realized there was no sound or movement from within his. "Have you gone to bed?" I said, aghast.
"Yep,"
he replied in a kind of affirmative growl. "That's it? You've retired, with no dinner?"
"Yep."
I stood for a minute, speechless and flummoxed, too tired to be indignant, too tired to be hungry either, come to that. I crawled into my tent, brought in a water bottle and book, laid out my knife and flashlight for purposes of nocturnal illumination and defense, and finally shimmied into the bag, more grateful than I have ever been to be horizontal. I was asleep in moments. I don't believe I have ever slept so well. When I awoke, it was daylight. The inside of my tent was coated in a curious flaky rime, which I realized after a moment was all my nighttime snores, condensed and frozen and pasted to the fabric, as if into a scrapbook of respiratory memories. My water bottle was frozen solid. This seemed gratifyingly macho, and I examined it with interest, as if it were a rare mineral. I was surprisingly snug in my bag, and in no hurry at all to put myself through the foolishness of climbing hills, so I just lay there, as if under grave orders not to move. After a while, I became aware that Katz was moving around outside, grunting softly, as if from aches, and doing something that sounded improbably industrious. After a minute or two, he came and crouched by my tent, his form a dark shadow on the fabric. He didn't ask if I was awake or anything, but just said in a quiet voice,
"Was I, would you say, a complete asshole last night?"
"Yes, you were, Stephen."
He was quiet for a moment. "I'm making coffee."
I gathered this was his way of an apology.
"That's very nice."
"Damn cold out here. And in here. My water bottle froze."
"Mine too."
I unzipped myself from my nylon womb and emerged on creaking joints. It seemed very strange, very novel, to be standing outdoors in long johns. Katz was crouched over the camp stove, boiling a pan of water. We seemed to be the only campers awake. It was cold, but perhaps just a trifle warmer than the day before, and a low dawn sun burning through the trees looked cautiously promising.
"How do you feel?"
he said. I flexed my legs experimentally.
"Not too bad, actually."
"Me either."
He poured water into the filter cone.
"I'm gonna be good today," he promised.
"Good."
I watched over his shoulder. "Is there a reason," I asked, "why you were filtering the coffee with toilet paper?"
I threw out the filter papers.
I gave a sound that wasn't quite a laugh.
They couldn't have weighed 2 ounces.
"I know, but they were great for throwing. Fluttered all over."
He dribbled on more water.
"The toilet paper seems to be working okay, though."
We watched it drip through and were strangely proud. Our first refreshment in the wilderness. He handed me a cup of coffee. It was swimming in grounds and little flecks of pink tissue, but it was piping hot, which was the main thing. He gave me an apologetic look.
"I threw out the brown sugar, too, so there won't be any sugar for the oatmeal."
Ah. Actually, there won't be any oatmeal for the oatmeal. I left it in New Hampshire. He looked at me.
Really?
Then added, as if for the record, I love oatmeal. What about some of that cheese? He shook his head. Flung. Peanuts? Flung. Spam?
Really flung.
This was beginning to sound a trifle grave. What about the bologna?
Oh, I ate that at Amicalola,
he said, as if it had been weeks ago, then added in a tone of sudden magnanimous concession,
Hey, I'm happy with a cup of coffee and a couple Little Debbies.
I gave a small grimace. I left the Little Debbies, too. His face expanded.
You left the Little Debbies?
I nodded apologetically.
All of them?
I nodded. He breathed out hard. This really was grave, a serious challenge apart from anything else to his promised equanimity. We decided we had better take inventory. We cleared a space on the ground sheet and pooled our commissary. It was startlingly austere. Some dried noodles, one bag of rice, raisins, coffee, salt, a good supply of candy bars and toilet paper. That was about it. We breakfasted on a Snickers bar and coffee, packed up our camp, hoisted our packs with a sideways stagger, and set off once again.
I can't believe you left the Little Debbies,
Cat said, and immediately began to fall behind. Chapter 4 Woods are not like other spaces. To begin with, they are cubic. Their trees surround you, loom over you, press in from all sides. Woods choke off views and leave you muddled and without bearings. They make you feel small and confused and vulnerable, like a small child lost in a crowd of strange legs. Stand in a desert or prairie, and you know you're in a big space. Stand in a woods, and you only sense it. They are a vast, featureless nowhere, and they are alive. So woods are spooky. Quite apart from the thought that they may harbor wild beasts and armed, genetically challenged fellows named Zeke and Festus, there is something innately sinister about them, some ineffable thing that makes you sense an atmosphere of pregnant doom with every step and leaves you profoundly aware that you are out of your element and ought to keep your ears pricked. Though you tell yourself it's preposterous, you can't quite shake the feeling that you are being watched. You order yourself to be serene. It's just a woods, for goodness sake. But really, you are jumpier than Don Knotts with pistol drawn. Every sudden noise, the crack of a falling limb, the crash of a bolting deer, makes you spin in alarm and stifle a plea for mercy. Whatever mechanism within you is responsible for adrenaline, it has never been so sleek and polished, so keenly poised to pump out a warming squirt of adrenal fluid. Even asleep, you were a coiled spring. The American woods had been unnerving people for 300 years. The inestimably priggish and tiresome Henry David Thoreau thought nature was splendid, splendid indeed, so long as he could stroll to town for cakes and barley wine. But when he experienced real wilderness, on a visit to Katahdin in 1846, he was unnerved to the core. This wasn't the tame world of overgrown orchards and sun-dappled paths that passed for wilderness in suburban Concord, Massachusetts, but a forbidding, oppressive, primeval country that was grim and wild, savage and dreary, fit only for men nearer of kin to the rocks and wild animals than we. The experience left him, in the words of one biographer, near hysterical. But even men far tougher and more attuned to the wilderness than Thoreau were sobered by its strange and palpable menace. Daniel Boone, who not only wrestled bears but tried to date their sisters, described corners of the southern Appalachians as so wild and horrid that it is impossible to behold them without terror. When Daniel Boone is uneasy, you know it's time to watch your step. When the first Europeans arrived in the New World, there were perhaps 950 million acres of woodland in what would become the lower 48 states. The Chattahoochee Forest, through which Katz and I now trudged, was part of an immense, unbroken canopy stretching from southern Alabama to Canada and beyond, and from the shores of the Atlantic to the distant grasslands of the Missouri River. Most of that forest is now gone, but what survives is more impressive than you might expect. The Chattahoochee is part of 4 million acres, 6,000 square miles, of federally owned forest, stretching up to the Great Smoky Mountains and beyond, and spreading sideways across 4 states. On a map of the United States, it is an incidental smudge of green, but on foot, the scale of it is colossal. It would be 4 days before Katz and I crossed a public highway, 8 days till we came to a town. And so we walked. We walked up mountains and through high, forgotten hollows, along lonesome ridges, with long views of more ridges, over grassy balds and down rocky, twisting, jarring descents, and through mile after endless mile of dark, deep, silent woods, on a wandering trail 18 inches wide and marked with rectangular white blazes, 2 inches wide, 6 long, slapped at intervals on the gray-barked trees. Walking is what we did. Compared with most other places in the developed world, America is still, to a remarkable extent, a land of forests. 1/3 of the landscape of the lower 48 states is covered in trees, 728 million acres in all. Maine alone has 10 million uninhabited acres. That's 15,600 square miles, an area considerably bigger than Belgium, without a single permanent resident. Altogether, just 2% of the United States is classified as built up. About 240 million acres of America's forests are owned by the government. The bulk of this, 191 million acres, spread over 155 parcels of land, is held by the U.S. Forest Service under the designations of national forests, national grasslands, and national recreation areas. All this sounds soothingly untrampled and ecological, but in fact a great deal of Forest Service land is designated multiple use, which is generously interpreted to allow any number of boisterous activities, mining, oil and gas extraction, ski resorts, 137 of them, condominium developments, snowmobiling, off-road vehicle scrambling, and lots and lots and lots of logging that seem curiously incompatible with woodland serenity. The Forest Service is truly an extraordinary institution. A lot of people, seeing that word forest in the title, assume it has something to do with looking after trees. In fact, no, though that was the original plan. It was conceived a century ago as a kind of woodland bank, a permanent repository of American timber, when people grew alarmed at the rate at which American forests were falling. Its mandate was to manage and protect these resources for the nation. These were not intended to be parks. Private companies would be granted leases to extract minerals and harvest timber, but they would be required to do so in a restrained, intelligent, sustainable way. In fact, mostly what the Forest Service does is build roads. I am not kidding. There are 378,000 miles of roads in America's national forests. That may seem a meaningless figure, but look at it this way. It is 8 times the total mileage of America's interstate highway system. It is the largest road system in the world in the control of a single body. The Forest Service has the second highest number of road engineers of any government institution on the planet. To say that these guys like to build roads barely hints at their level of dedication. Show them a strand of trees anywhere, and they will regard it thoughtfully for a long while and say at last, "You know, we could put a road here." It is the avowed aim of the U.S. Forest Service to construct 580,000 miles of additional forest road by the middle of the next century. The reason the Forest Service builds these roads, quite apart from the deep pleasure of doing noisy things in the woods with big yellow machines, is to allow private timber companies to get to previously inaccessible stands of trees. Of the Forest Service 150 million acres of loggable land, about 2/3 is held in store for the future. The remaining 1/3, 49 million acres, or an area roughly twice the size of Ohio, is available for logging. It allows huge swaths of land to be clear-cut, including, to take one recent but heartbreaking example, 209 acres of thousand-year-old redwoods in Oregon's Umpqua National Forest. In 1987, it casually announced that it would allow private timber interests to remove hundreds of acres of wood a year from the venerable and verdant Pisgah National Forest next door to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and that 80% of that would be through what it delicately calls scientific forestry, clear-cutting to you and me, which is not only a brutal visual affront to any landscape, but brings huge, reckless wash-offs that gully the soil, robbing it of nutrients and disrupting ecologies further downstream, sometimes for miles. This isn't science, it's rape. And yet, the Forest Service grinds on. By the late 1980s, this is so extraordinary I can hardly stand it, it was the only significant player in the American timber industry that was cutting down trees faster than it replaced them. Moreover, it was doing this with the most sumptuous inefficiency. 80% of its leasing arrangements lost money, often vast amounts. In one typical deal, the Forest Service sold 100-year-old lodgepole pines in the Targhee National Forest in Idaho for about $2 each, after spending $4 per tree surveying the land, drawing up contracts, and, of course, building roads. Between 1989 and 1997, it lost an average of $242 million a year, almost $2 billion all told, according to the Wilderness Society. This is also discouraging that I think we'll leave it here and return to our two lonely heroes trudging through the lost world of the Chattahoochee. The forest we walk through now was really just a strapping adolescent. In 1890, a railroad man from Cincinnati named Henry C. Bagley came to this part of Georgia, saw the stately white pines and poplars, and was so moved by their towering majesty and abundance that he decided to chop them all down. They were worth a lot of money. Besides, freighting the timber to northern mills would keep his railroad cars puffing. In consequence, over the next 30 years, nearly all the hills of northern Virginia were turned into sunny groves of stumps. By 1920, foresters in the South were taking away 15.4 billion board feet of timber a year. It wasn't until the 1930s, when the Chattahoochee Forest was officially formed, that nature was invited back in. There is a strange frozen violence in a forest out of season. Every glade and dale seemed to have just completed some massive cataclysm. Downed trees lay across the path every 50 or 60 yards, often with great bomb craters of dirt around their splayed roots. Dozens more lay rotting on the slopes, and every third or fourth tree, it seemed, was leaning steeply on a neighbor. It was as if the trees couldn't wait to fall over, as if their sole purpose in the universal scheme of things was to grow big enough to topple with a really good, splintering crash. I was forever coming up to trees so precariously and weightily tipped over the path that I would waver, then scoot under, fearing the crush of really unfortunate timing, and imagining cats coming along a few minutes later, regarding my wriggling legs and saying, "Shit, Bryson, what are you doing under there?" But no trees fell. Everywhere the woods were still and preternaturally quiet, except for the occasional gurgle of running water and the tiny shuffle of wind-stirred leaves along the forest floor, there was almost never a sound. The woods were silent because spring had not yet come. In a normal year, we would be walking into the zestful bounty of a southern mountain spring through a radiant, productive, newborn world alive with the zip of insects and the fussy twitter of birds, a world bursting with fresh, wholesome air and that rich, velvety, lung-filling smell of chlorophyll you get when you push through low, leafy branches. Above all, there would be wildflowers in dazzling profusion, blossoming from every twig, pushing valiantly through the fertile litter on the forest floor, carpeting every sunny slope and stream bank, trillium and trailing arbutus, Dutchman's breeches, jack-in-the-pulpit, mandrake, violets, snowy bluets, buttercups and bloodroot, dwarf iris, columbine, and wood sorrel, and other cheerful, nodding wonders almost beyond counting. There are 1,500 types of wildflower in the southern Appalachians, 40 rare types in the northern Georgia woods alone. They are a sight to lift the hardest heart, but they were not to be seen in the woods this grim March. We trudged through a cold, silent world of bare trees beneath pewter skies, on ground like iron. We fell into a simple routine. Each morning we rose at first light, shivering and rubbing arms, made coffee, broke down camp, ate a couple of fistfuls of raisins, and set off into the silent woods. We would walk from about 7:30 to 4. We seldom walked together. Our paces didn't match. But every couple of hours I would sit on a log, always surveying the surrounding undergrowth for the rustle of bear or boar, and wait for cats to catch up, to make sure everything was okay. Sometimes other hikers would come along and tell me where Katz was and how he was progressing, which was nearly always slowly but gamely. The trail was much harder for him than for me, and to his credit he tried not to bitch. It never escaped me for a moment that he didn't have to be there. I had thought we would have a jump on the crowds, but there was a fair scattering of other hikers, 3 students from Rutgers University in New Jersey, an astounding fit older couple with tiny packs hiking to their daughter's wedding in far-off Virginia, a gawky kid from Florida named Jonathan. Perhaps 2 dozen of us all together in the same general neck of the woods, all heading north. Because everyone walks at different rates and rests at different times, 3 or 4 times a day you bump into some or all of your fellow hikers, especially on mountaintops with panoramic views, or beside streams with good water, and above all at the wooden shelters that stand at distant intervals, ostensibly, but not always actually, a day's hike apart in clearings just off the trail. In consequence, you get to know your fellow hikers at least a little, quite well if you meet them nightly at the shelters. You become part of an informal clump, a loose and sympathetic affiliation of people from different age groups and walks of life, but all experiencing the same weather, same discomforts, same landscapes, same eccentric impulse to hike to Maine. Even at busy times, however, the woods are great providers of solitude, and I encountered long periods of perfect aloneness, when I didn't see another soul for hours, many times when I would wait for cats for a long spell, and no other hiker would come along. When that happened, I would leave my pack and go back and find him, to see that he was all right, which always pleased him. Sometimes he would be proudly bearing my stick, which I had left by a tree when I had stopped to tie my laces or adjust my pack. We seemed to be looking out for each other. It was very nice. I can put it no other way. Around 4, we would find a spot to camp and pitch our tents. One of us would go off to fetch and filter water, while the other prepared a sludge of steamy noodles. Sometimes we would talk, but mostly we existed in a kind of companionable silence. By 6 o'clock, dark and cold and weariness would drive us to our tents. Cats went to sleep instantly, as far as I could tell. I would read for an hour or so with my curiously inefficient little miner's lamp, its beam throwing quirky, concentric circles of light onto the page, like the light of a bicycle lamp, until my shoulders and arms grew chilly out of the bag and heavy from tilting the book at awkward angles to catch the nervous light. So I would put myself in darkness and lie there listening to the peculiarly clear, articulated noises of the forest at night, the sighs and fidgets of wind and leaves, the weary groan of boughs, the endless murmurings and stirrings, like the noises of a convalescent ward after lights out, until at last I fell heavily asleep. In the morning we would rise, shivering and rubbing arms, wordlessly repeat our small chores, fill and hoist our packs, and venture into the great and tangling forest again. On the 4th evening we made a friend. We were sitting in a nice little clearing beside the trail, our tents pitched, eating our noodles, savoring the exquisite pleasure of just sitting, when a plumpish, bespectacled young woman in a red jacket and the customary outsized pack came along. She regarded us with the crinkled squint of someone who is either chronically confused or can't see very well. We exchanged hellos and the usual banalities about the weather and where we were. Then she squinted at the gathering gloom and announced she would camp with us. Her name was Mary Ellen. She was from Florida, and she was, as Katz forever after termed her, in a special tone of awe, a piece of work. She talked non-stop, except when she was clearing out her eustachian tubes, which she did frequently, by pinching her nose and blowing out with a series of violent and alarming snorts of a sort that would make a dog leave the sofa and get under a table in the next room. I have long known that it is part of God's plan for me to spend a little time with each of the most stupid people on earth, and Mary Ellen was proof that even in the Appalachian woods I would not be spared. It became evident from the first moment that she was a rarity.
"So, what are you guys eating?"
she said, plonking herself down on a spare log and lifting her head to peer into our bowls.
"Noodles? Big mistake. Noodles have got, like, no energy. I mean, like, zero."
She unblocked her ears.
"Is that a starship tent?"
I looked at my tent. "I don't know."
"Big mistake. They must have seen you coming at the camp store. Would you pay for it?"
"I don't know."
"Too much, that's how much. You should have gotten a three-season tent."
"It is a three-season tent.
Pardon me saying so, but it is, like, seriously dumb to come out here in March without a three-season tent."
She unblocked her ears.
"It is a three-season tent.
You're lucky you haven't froze yet. You should go back and, like, punch out the guy that sold it to you, because he's, like, been, like, you know, negligible selling you that."
"Believe me, it is a three-season tent."
She unblocked her ears and shook her head impatiently.
"That's a three-season tent."
She indicated Katz's tent.
"That's exactly the same tent."
She glanced at it again.
"Whatever. How many miles did you do today?"
"About 10.
Actually, we had done 8.4, but this had included several formidable escarpments, including a notable wall of hell called Preaching Rock, the highest eminence in Springer Mountain, for which we had awarded ourselves bonus miles, for purposes of morale.
10 miles? Is that all? You guys must be, like, really out of shape. I did 14, too.
"How many of your lips done?"
said Katz, looking up from his noodles.
She fixed him with one of her more severe squints. "Same as the rest of me, of course."
She gave me a private look as if to say, "Is your friend, like, seriously weird or something?" She cleared her ears.
"I started at Gooch Gap."
"So did we. That's only 8.4 miles. She shook her head sharply, as if shooing a particularly tenacious fly.
14.2.
"No, really, it's only 8.4.
"Excuse me, but I just walked it. I think I ought to know."
And then suddenly,
"God, are those Timberland boots? Mega mistake. How much did you pay for them?"
And so it went. Eventually, I went off to swill out the bowls and hang the food bag. When I came back, she was fixing her own dinner, but still talking away at Katz.
"You know what your problem is?"
she was saying.
"Pardon my French, but you're too fat."
Katz looked at her in quiet wonder.
"Excuse me?"
"You're too fat. You should have lost weight before you came out here. Should have done some training, 'cause you could have, like, a serious, you know, heart thing out here."
"Heart thing?"
"You know, when your heart stops and you, like, you know, die."
"Do you mean a heart attack?"
"That's it."
Mary Ellen, it should be noted, was not short on flesh herself, and unwisely at that moment she leaned over to get something from her pack, displaying an expanse of backside on which you could have projected motion pictures for, let us say, an army base. It was an interesting test of Katz's forbearance. He said nothing, but rose to go for a pee. And out of the side of his mouth, as he passed me, he rendered a certain convenient expletive as 3 low, dismayed syllables, like the call of a freight train in the night. The next day, as always, we rose chilled and feeling wretched, and set about the business of attending to our small tasks, but this time with the additional strain of having our every move examined and rated. While we ate raisins and drank coffee with flecks of toilet paper in it, Mary Ellen gorged on a multi-course breakfast of oatmeal, Pop-Tarts, trail mix, and a dozen small squares of chocolate, which she lined up in a row on the log beside her. We watched like orphaned refugees while she plumped her jowls with food and enlightened us as to our shortcomings with regard to diet, equipment, and general manliness. And then, now a trio, we set off into the woods. Mary Ellen walked sometimes with me and sometimes with Katz, but always with one of us. It was apparent that for all her bluster she was majestically inexperienced and untrailworthy. She hadn't the faintest idea how to read a map, for one thing, and ill at ease on her own in the wilderness. I couldn't help feeling a little sorry for her. Besides, I began to find her strangely entertaining. She had the most extraordinarily redundant turn of phrase. She would say things like, "There's a stream of water over there," and, "It's nearly 10 o'clock a.m. Once, in reference to winters in central Florida, she solemnly informed me, "We usually get frosts once or twice a winter, but this year we had 'em a couple of times." Katz, for his part, clearly dreaded her company and winced beneath her tireless urgings to smarten his pace. For once, the weather was kindly, more autumnal than spring-like in feel, but gratifyingly mild. By 10 o'clock, the temperature was comfortably in the 60s. For the first time since Amicalola, I took off my jacket and realized with mild perplexity that I had absolutely no place to put it. I tied it to my pack with a strap and trudged on. We labored 4 miles up and over Blood Mountain, at 4,461 feet, the highest and toughest eminence on the trail in Georgia. Then began a steep and exciting 2-mile descent towards Neal's Gap. Exciting because there was a shop at Neal's Gap, at a place called the Wallasee Yee Inn, where you could buy sandwiches and ice cream. At about 1:30, we heard a novel sound, motor traffic. And a few minutes later, we emerged from the woods onto U.S. Highway 19 and 129, which, despite having 2 numbers, was really just a back road through a high pass between wooded nowheres. Directly across the road was the Wallasee Yee Inn, a splendid stone building constructed by the Civilian Conservation Corps, a kind of army of the unemployed, during the Great Depression, and now a combination hiking outfitters, grocery, bookshop, and youth hostel. We hastened across the road, positively scurried across, and went inside. Now it may seem to stretch credibility to suggest that things like a paved highway, the whoosh of passing cars, and a proper building could seem exciting and unfamiliar after a scant 5 days in the woods, but in fact, it was so. Just passing through a door, being inside, surrounded by walls and a ceiling, was novel. And the Wallasee Yee's stuff was, well, I can't begin to describe how wonderful it was. There was a single modest-sized refrigerator filled with fresh sandwiches, soft drinks, cartons of juice, and perishables like cheese, and Katz and I stared into it for ages, dumbly captivated. I was beginning to appreciate that the central feature of life on the Appalachian Trail is deprivation, that the whole point of the experience is to remove yourself so thoroughly from the conveniences of everyday life that the most ordinary things, processed cheese, a can of pop gorgeously beaded with condensation, fill you with wonder and gratitude. It is an intoxicating experience to taste Coca-Cola as if for the first time and to be conveyed to the very brink of orgasm by white bread. Makes all the discomfort worthwhile, if you ask me. Katz and I bought 2 egg salad sandwiches each, some potato chips, chocolate bars, and soft drinks, and went to a picnic table in back, where we ate with greedy smackings and expressions of rapture, then returned to the refrigerator to stare and wonder some more. The Wallasee Yee, we discovered, provided other services to bona fide hikers for a small fee. Laundry center, showers, towel rental. And we greedily availed ourselves of all those. The shower was a dribbly antiquated affair, but the water was hot, and I have never, and I mean never, enjoyed a grooming experience more. I watched with the profoundest satisfaction as 5 days of grime ran down my legs and out the drain hole, and noticed with astonished gratitude that my body had taken on a noticeably svelter profile. We did 2 loads of laundry, washed out our cups and food bowls and pots and pans, bought and sent postcards, phoned home, and stocked up liberally on fresh and packaged foods in the shop. The Wallasee Yee was run by an Englishman named Justin and his American wife Peggy, and we fell into a running conversation with them as we drifted in and out through the afternoon. Peggy told me that already they had had 1,000 hikers through since January 1st, with the real start of the hiking season still to come. They were a kindly couple, and I got the sense that Peggy in particular spends a lot of her time talking people into not quitting. Only the day before, A young man from Surrey had asked them to call him a cab to take him to Atlanta. Peggy had almost persuaded him to persevere, to try for just another week. But in the end he had broken down and wept quietly, and asked from the heart to be let go home. My own feeling was that for the first time